Sing and rejoice, ye people of the Tower of Guard, for your watch hath not been in vain, and the black gate is broken, and your king hath passed through, and he is victorious.
It is episode 67 of the Grey Company podcast. Today on the show, we continue our book club and look at the chapters The Field of Cormallin, The Steward and the King, and Many Partings. Before we get into the discussion and introduce our guest for today, let's check in with the other member of the crew who's with me right now. Dan, how are you, buddy?
I'm lonely.
No.
It's just like in Middle
Earth,
at
the top.
It turns out it's very difficult to assemble the entire Grey Company.
Yeah, it is. It is.
We need like an elf and an act of a, you know, an act of God or something to get all of us together at once. I'm well. I had a wonderful holidays and a very happy new year. So I'm glad to get back to the book club, though I've missed this.
Yeah, dude. And I read this a while ago.
Excited about our special guest as well.
Yes. Well, our super duper extra very special guest.
Yeah, I'm worth at least two missing co-hosts.
Yeah. You make up for both Ian and Matthew. We are joined today by the lead developer of the Lord of the Rings, the card game, someone you may or may not have heard of, Mr. Caleb Grace. How are you today?
Doing well. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm excited to talk about the Lord of the Rings with you. I don't know if you're excited to not have to answer like the same questions over and over again about the game, but I'm really excited to talk about the book with you.
No rules questions.
Oh, bold statement.
There aren't any custom cards, so we don't have to worry about you like verifying that they're good or anything like that. We can just talk about the book. And yeah, and I'm excited because I have to assume that you have a well-thumbed copy of the Lord of the Rings like sitting at your desk up there at Fantasy Flight.
Yep. It's actually Nate French's copy.
Okay.
Mine are like treasured belongings at home that like stay high on the bookshelf out of the reach of my kids.
Okay. So his copy has been sacrificed for the cause.
Yeah, he just kind of handed it to me when I took the job. He was like, "You're gonna need this more than me."
Okay, so
instead of
passing on like the crown of Gondor, he gave you the book. Okay, that's fitting fitting for our discussion today. Awesome. Well, let's do it. So the way we do each book club is we will do a quick recap of each chapter, then we'll discuss the book itself, how we felt about it, what we liked about it, any interesting thoughts we had, and then we will take some time to discuss the cards that go along with this chapter. And we begin tonight with the Field of Cormallin. So the chapter begins with us seeing the aftermath of the destruction of the ring. The Eagles arrive just as the servants of Mordor flee the battle. Frodo and Sam leave the Samath Naur and find there is no escape from Mount Doom, but they are rescued by Gandalf and Gwaihir. Caw, caw, Matthew! They rest at the Field of Cormallin and rejoin their friends. They are honored by the armies of both Gondor and Rohan before returning to Minas Tirith. So I just start off by saying I love the beginning of this chapter. It is so freaking epic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did a good job with this in the films as well. Just the sense of like, you know, the last thing we saw at the battle was Pippin getting KO'd, and then something about the Eagles, and all hope is lost. And then all of a sudden the Eagles show up, and like the bad guys are fleeing, and the Orduin is blowing up. Man, it's just such an exciting scene.
Just the way you said Pippin gets KO'd, I just imagined him like, you know, like in a video game, he gets knocked over. KO.
With a little sound effect. Doo doo doo.
Right. Have you, this is a total tangent already. Before we even get started, I'm a tangent. Have you guys seen the Legolas kill count video on YouTube?
No, but it's going to be in the show notes.
Oh, do yourselves a favor. This video is so funny. It goes through the entire Lord of the Rings movie trilogy into the Hobbit movie trilogy. And it just
Oh,
shows
wow.
every single Legolas kill, and it's done in the form of like a Dance Dance Revolution type, video game where it's like, combo, super combo, hyper
C-c-c-combo.
combo, and
That's epic.
there's like a point at which he like shoots the ladder at Helm's Deep and it like falls down on the orcs and it's like genocidal or something. So as soon as you said Pippin gets KO'd, I heard that dude's voice in my head, like,
C-c-c-combo.
KO.
That's almost as
Nice.
good as the how it should have ended, where Legolas leaps out of the bushes after Smaug leaves the Lonely Mountain, shoots him. It's like, I got him, guys. They're like, you're not even in this book.
That's awesome.
Anyways,
Yes.
so where to begin?
I'm sure that's exactly how Tolkien imagined it. Like,
Yes, smoking his pipe
massive
there
kill
and his, yeah.
counts. Yeah.
I'm
Oh,
sure
it's
you.
really fun too. Gosh, I'm really on this tangent, but the fun thing about the video is you can see how in Fellowship of the Ring, like, Legolas is just like he's a really good archer. He's really fast. He's super accurate. And there's a little suspension of disbelief, but mostly just like, okay, he's an elf, maybe he can move that fast. And then it gets a little crazier, and in the second movie, surfing, a shield down the stairs, and then in the third one is just like God mode, where he's like killing an entire Mumak by himself, and it just gets like more and more absurd as you watch the video.
What's funny is that, like, this in the film, this particular scene we're talking about in the book, like you said, Legolas goes on God mode, and then, like, in the movies, at this battle before the ring is destroyed, Aragorn's like about to get smushed by a troll, and Legolas just like is like just can't get past the orcs. Excuse me, pardon me. Like, he can't. He's trying to get to save Aragorn, and then he's just like, oh, sorry, guys. Excuse me. Oh, he can't even, he can't do like his ninja flip over on top of him to save his best friend, but he can one-shot a Mumak.
Mumox can't stop him, but writers can.
That's right.
Yeah, this is, I guess, at the heart of the difference between the books and the movies, right? Is the books don't really have a lot in the way of artificial conflict, because a lot of those examples are like in the second movie when Legolas somehow can't hit the guy that's going to blow up, Helm's Deep or whatever. Just like
Aragorn even
he's been
yells in Sylvan and
bullseyeing
everything.
everyone. It's midnight or whatever, and he's bullseyeing everyone, never misses, and then he somehow misses this guy like three times in a row. That's the critical like plot point. The books don't really have that kind of artificial conflict.
Yeah, it's interesting going back and like reading the books, because in my mind, they've always been really action-packed. Like that's the one of the things I love about rereading them is the action for me has always been on this epic scale. But when you read the actual passage, it's like it's not very descriptive at all. It's like
No.
the bow of Legolas was singing and Andoril shined, and you're like, okay, that's awesome.
Yeah, and that's I read this to my now 7-year-old. I guess I read it last year, so she was 6. And that's part of the reason why I didn't have a problem reading it to her is because the like even when at the Battle of the record hall in Moria, like Aragorn beheads an orc chieftain, and it's just like I think that's it. Like he chopped his head off, and that was it. There's doesn't describe like any more than that. So even though there's some spooky stuff in here that I was concerned about from her, it was not the violence. And even like in the battle we're describing here, like there's just not, like you said, it does not get very just very visceral. I'm kind of a fan of that. Like I read a. Oh, go ahead, Dan.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, Tolkien doesn't seem enamored with the grotesque aspect of war. If anything, he's probably on the other side of that.
Yeah, sure. For sure.
Yeah, he always to me seemed more interested in like the strategies and tactics. And I think that's part of what appeals to like the gamer in me is like reading like how the Witch King held this army in reserve at the Battle of Pelennor Fields, and when the Witch King fell, then Gothmog like sent in the reserves, and like maybe other people just don't even care about that, but I'm always like fascinated, like, oh, that's cool, that was a strategy,
Right, it's more strategic than tactical necessarily.
Yeah, like the use of horns to signal, like the horn to signal the charge, the horn to signal the withdraw and everything.
Didn't mean to break into your earlier point though, Derek. I don't know where you were
Oh, I
going
was
with
just saying
that.
that, like, even I haven't watched Game of Thrones because I'm kind of squeamish, but even reading the book, like some of the and other books too I've read recently that are just so gross that like they're almost upsetting. Whereas the Lord of the Rings has some genuinely upsetting moments, but the narrative is not such that like it gets it across without needing to be very graphic, which as a sensitive hobbit soul, I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's my preference too, honestly. I enjoy Martin's world building. I think the world of Westeros is really really interesting and really cool. But when you actually read the books, yeah, they're too graphic for me as well. They kind of leave me feeling a little squeamish or dirty or something. Like you never have that feeling reading The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings, you know.
I couldn't help but think it's 2 pages into this chapter. There's a part where Gandalf says the realm of Sauron has is ended. The Ring Bearer has fulfilled his quest, and I just get this mental image of a progress token hitting a quest card. Quest completed.
Fulfilled his. You have your fulfilled your quest. Yeah, that's funny.
That's amazing.
That's perfect.
That is such an epic moment, though, right? When like. I going all the way back to where you were actually trying to talk about the chapter before I interrupted. You were talking about such
Combo
a,
breaker.
yeah, right? It's such an epic beginning with just the raging battle, the Nazgul and the eagles up above, and then all of a sudden there's the moment of doom, right? When Gandalf shouts like, "Stand, men of the West, stand and wait. This is the hour of doom." And gosh, I get shivers, you know, just like everything we've been reading through. Three books to get to this point, you know, this is the moment that you thought might never come.
Right, and
Yeah, that.
especially coupling it with like you said, the whole book building up to this point, but even the struggle in the Chamber of Fire, like we're knowing what Frodo just went through and how Gollum actually kind of saved the day in some weird
Yeah,
new
right.
catastrophic way. Yeah, it's just layers and layers of meaning.
I can't help but notice the a thread throughout the last several chapters that we've covered is like there's fatalism is front and center, and yet again when he's saying like Hour of Doom, like they're all assuming going to the field of Pormallen, like this is where I'm going to die. You know, the odds of the Ring Bearer succeeding are, you know, like it's a remote hope, but we're basically preparing ourselves for that. And then I think it's interesting that even as they're sitting there after it's done, and Frodo kind of is probably disappointed in himself for, you know, ultimately like not being able to resist the temptation of the ring, but then they're basically like, well, at least we're together here at the end of all things, but they're also preparing themselves to die, which is kind of a weird symmetry there. Like here they've succeeded and yet they're ready to die. And it's a theme that carries on into the next chapter, and I think that's the first time we see a real break in that pattern where Eowyn represents that break. But it's just interesting to look at that as a common thread through all these latter chapters.
That touches on something I was thinking about because what I'm always amazed by these books and particularly these, you know, final chapters is every time I read them, I feel the suspense and I feel like the, you know, what's going to happen. Of course, I know exactly what's going to happen, but I still get emotionally invested like every single time. And maybe part of it's just because it's nostalgia or something, you know, from reading it so young as a kid, but I'm not convinced that's all of it. And I'm not sure exactly what it is. You talk about fatalism, and I think part of it's just he does such a great job of painting such a bleak picture that you're like, how could they ever get out from this, you know?
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. I think the fact that there's real suffering going on, especially on the part of poor Frodo, because whereas Sam, for one reason or another, has hobbit sense, or just the fact that he hasn't been carrying the ring, is physically exhausted. Frodo is also going through this like psychic, emotional exhaustion too. And so I think, especially with Frodo, the suffering that he goes through, that pulls us in every time, just because. At least for me, the other guys are, you know, they have their own thing going on, but especially I think the kind of tragic cycle that Frodo is in, it helps us to get emotionally involved.
Yeah, and just how much torment there must be from having this thing that, like, Tolkien just shows you how the ring won in the Battle of Wills between Frodo and the ring. You know, the ring comes out on top, and then he is, you know, a part of its destruction. He's got to be really, That's got to be a traumatic moment to have this thing that you've become obsessed with, and then it's been destroyed, kind of at your own, I guess, literally at your own hand.
Or finger.
But yeah, it's and Tolkien is one of the things Tolkien does that I like is he doesn't talk a lot about exactly what the characters feel, which I think is better writing. Like, it would be really boring if it got emo and he went into that. But you can kind of like it's you can read between the lines on that really poignant scene between Frodo and Sam as they're sitting there and like the volcano is, you know, erupting around them, and they're like, well, we can't run away in time. We just kind of accept our fate. And I don't know. It's a beautiful moment, and you're right. Sam's character really shines through there. His like common, you know, gardener hobbit heroism is really a beautiful counterpoint to all these, you know, like you have all these captains of the West and all these important people and Gandalf and the eagles, and the eagles implies that like maybe the gods are involved a little bit there or something, you know. Manwë or whatever. But then you have just Sam, the gardener from the Shire, is just kind of like, well, you know, at least we have each other. And he's just always like, even in that situation, he's able to find a bright side to things.
Yeah. And in that sense, he's actually kind of the one that saves him, because Frodo's just kind of like, well, I'm done. We're just going to die. And then Sam at least talks him into leaving the chamber. So they're outside and they're spotted by the eagles. Yeah. Sam's like, Frodo's like, if you wish to go, I'll come. You know, he's kind of consigned himself to death. And as you said, Dan, like the loss of the, what he's gone through, and then the loss, ultimate loss of the ring is such a blow to him. And we see that very clearly in the latter, the very last chapter anyway. So yeah, it's Sam that saves the day yet again.
Yeah, underrated hero of the whole narrative in a way.
Yeah, it's, I find that debate, if you like, to be very interesting, because even Tolkien said in his letters that Sam was the ultimate hero, and I've often felt very sympathetic towards Frodo, and I find myself getting more sympathetic towards his character the more I read the book. So, and then even in the I don't know if it's the Grey Havens or the subsequent chapter or the previous chapter, but they talk about how Sam is mayor several times and he's well respected, but Frodo is never really well respected back home. And so I think trying to, you know, there's a lot of territory for debate there, debating like who's who's underrated, who's doesn't get the appreciation they deserve, and it's always that kind of seeing heroes not get the recognition they want is always, or that they should get, is always interesting to me. Like even that the end of the Dark Knight movie comes to mind, where like Batman just takes it all on himself to save his friends. Anyway, that's very interesting to me.
Yeah, I no, I think that's super important though. Like I don't mind dwelling on that for a minute, because I think this is at the heart of what Tolkien's trying to say with this is, you know, he obviously was in World War One, and I think that he sees heroism often as common people doing, you know, like things that aren't recognized after the fact as extraordinary. Like no one would specifically call out like, oh, Sam convinced Frodo to go from the chamber to this like outcropping, right? And they're both thinking they're going to die. That's inconsequential, right? Who cares? But him doing that, him having the like hobbit sense of like, well, we're going to die, but let's go to the outcropping, is actually really freaking important. And those are the kind of things that are, I think Tolkien sees that as heroism, is like just simple people doing simple things, and history kind of, you know, moves right past it, but it actually ends up being really important.
Yeah, that's true of a lot of veterans as well. You know, they go through something terrible and they come back to real life, and then, you know, they don't, they get some recognition as veterans, but you know, nobody can really know what they've gone through. And I think we can definitely see Sam and Frodo as being veterans in this sense for all the stuff they went through.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is kind of amazing to watch like how quickly the Shire in, you know, when in those later chapters when they get back and things are kind of getting back to normal, how quickly everyone in the Shire just kind of forgets that Frodo even left, you know?
Yeah,
Like,
yeah.
it's so outside of their scope of understanding to even begin to fathom what he went through, and they're just like, oh, you left and you're back now. That's great.
Or even the way the
Yeah, he's
gaffer
up.
reacts to Sam coming home. He's like, I hope my Sam didn't give you any trouble, you know?
You're right. Yeah, I love that line where like when Rosie's like, well, what are you gonna ditch Frodo like now after all this away? He's like, you know, it either demanded like this really long answer or none at all. So Sam just turned and left.
Nice. Yeah, there's some poetry in amidst this. I think he does a really good job of creating like there's a contrast where things have been really heavy and he has the epic climactic stuff, and then immediately after that he's actually sneaking a little bit of poetry in, where the way he contrasts the bleakness and the sameness of Mordor, like they end up when they, inevitably you have the like then the heroes fall unconscious and then they wake up somewhere else kind of trope that Tolkien, it's not a trope when he does it because he was one of the first to do that, but they wake up in Ithilien. And he starts describing like how soft the bed is and the fragrance of Ithilien and all these things. And like I noticed that because all the Sam and Frodo chapters for like chapter after chapter after chapter get very bleak. They're so just like reinforcing how terrible and hellish Mordor is. And then you have this like, oh, and they wake up in Ithilien. And it's just
Have a
total
what?
contrast.
Actually, as we were talking about like Sam and Frodo not getting the recognition they're due, it reminded me that actually probably my favorite part of this chapter, aside from like just the epicness of the downfall of Sauron, is when Frodo and Sam do get their recognition, right? When it's all the great captains and lords that we've seen marching to war. It's Aragorn as the king, and I love that Aragorn takes them and like leads them up to his throne and he seats them there himself and then bows down. Like I'm getting choked up talking about it. That part, that's like I don't know. I'm a good old-fashioned stoic Swede, but that moment always gets me because I think there's something that I just love about people who are just kind of quietly doing good, unselfishly. It's so easy to miss that or ignore it, overlook it. But in this moment, it's like Aragorn's like, no, you two come up here, come be seated on the throne, come get the recognition you deserve. And so I love that moment where he's like, long live the halflings, praise them with great praise, And then they're so like self-conscious and they don't know what to do. And then don't they they like the isn't this where Gleowyn shows up? Like he comes to sing the song of Frodo of the Nine Fingers and the Ring of Doom. And Sam's just like clapping for joy, like, oh my gosh. Yeah, he
Glory
says,
and splendor.
oh, great glory and splendor, and all my wishes have come true. And he wept. And that's like about the point where I join him,
Dude.
It's such a cool moment. I love that it's like everything's been so bleak up to this point. And then, like, on the turn of a page, it's like Dan said, suddenly everything's beautiful and good. And everybody's laughing like Gandalf laughs, and it's the sound of all joy, like this guy who's been so grim and serious this whole time,
Yeah, for so long.
and now he's just
I mean,
laughing.
he had the even longer quest when you look at it and you take a step back and think about the ages of Middle Earth, and his fight went even past, further back. But it's gonna sound cheesy, but honestly, I really like I'm at a point in my career where I'm actually managing other people, and I really look to Aragorn as an inspiration for like good leadership. Because one of the things that he does is he gives recognition to other people, and he has enough humility to allow other people to step to the front at times. And I think like that's just one of many reasons why I think Aragorn's an amazing leader in this book. But it probably does sound kind of cornball to say like taking this book as inspiration in your everyday life, but I very much do, because I think that example of like him putting he doesn't have to put Frodo on his throne, right? Like he has his own reasons why he won his throne through merit. It's not like he did nothing, but instead of doing that, he has humility and he puts everyone else in a situation where they have to acknowledge the sacrifice, that Frodo made to do what he did. And it's just, I don't know, it's a really inspirational, like I don't think it's cheesy to cry at all to this book, because at the end of the book I definitely get a tear in my eye too at different spots.
Yeah, and contrast Aragorn with Denethor. Like, would someone like Denethor have had the humility and good leadership to actually, give them this big moment, or would they have felt threatened by it? Certainly a character like Sauron would have just been completely threatened by it. Probably would have had him killed or something. So it's cool. It speaks to just the conception of goodness in the world that he built. Caleb, you mentioned world building with Martin. I think even things like that, the way Aragorn treats Frodo and Sam at this point is contributing to that good world building, pointing to what does archetypal good look like in Middle Earth? What does nobility look like in Middle Earth? We'll get into some of that too when we get to the next chapter with the tree and stuff. But yeah, it's cool, man. It's a tearjerker for sure.
Yeah, honestly, when you guys like first reached out to me to ask if I want to do the book club, and you offered maybe this group of chapters or the previous one, and I was like, oh, I definitely want to talk about Field of Cormallen, because I think it's one of my all-time favorite chapters. But you wouldn't think about that when you think about Lord of the Rings. You know, you would think about, well, maybe it's the Battle of Helm's Deep or the Battle of Pelennor Fields or the Destruction of the Ring, or, you know, all of these epic moments to choose from. And I've heard Tolkien criticized for how, like, you know, they destroy the ring, but then the book goes on for several more chapters, you know, and they're like, the story's over. Why are we still going? And I couldn't disagree more.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I love these books so much is because they keep going till we get all the way back to Bag End, where it started. You know, yeah. And I love that. I love that it comes full circle and you get to see everybody, how they're going to go their own way and what they're like now that the reign of Sauron is over.
Yeah.
And so I cherish these chapters. I just love getting to see the falling action and the resolution.
Yeah.
And I even think the Scouring of the Shire is essential, right? Because you take characters like Merry and Pippin that are you know, ancillary characters throughout most of the narrative, and they kind of come into their own near the end. But then you put them, they return home, as you say, like the story comes full circle, but then they're not the same, right? You see the way they act in the Shire, in their home, defending it. And at the end of the book, and if you took those two characters at the beginning of the book and put them in that situation, they would have been hopeless.
Right. Yeah, I almost feel like Tolkien speaks directly through Gandalf at one point when Gandalf leaves them to go visit Tom Bombadil. And they're like, hey, well, if there's trouble, aren't you going to come help? He's like, no, this is what you've been preparing for. And I do feel like you can't see how much they've grown until you put them back in their original setting. And you see exactly like you said, right, that when they confront the ruffians, you know, later, and yeah, at the beginning of the books, they probably would have, like, Pippin probably would have peed himself and ran away or something, you know. But instead, he gets one of my favorite lines in the whole trilogy when the guy's like thumbing his nose at Frodo, and he says, this is a friend of the king that you're talking to, and I'm a knight of the king. And he draws his sword. He's like, now you get down and apologize. I'll put this troll's bane in you. And you're like, he's not kidding.
Yeah.
Like, he killed a troll with that sword. Right. Now some ruffian thinks he's going to intimidate him.
Yeah.
And that moment for me sort of encapsulates, like, boy, how much they've grown and how far they've come. You know, and especially for Frodo, too, that his journey led him to be like a pacifist, you know, that at the end there, he doesn't
I love that.
Anymore. Like, even in this chapter, they give him a sword to wear to the dinner, and he says, I never want to wear a sword again. And Gandalf, he wears it because Gandalf says, well, for tonight at least you should wear it. But he sort of acknowledges, like, yeah, that's fine. You don't have to ever wear a sword again.
Right.
Yeah, that is a beautiful moment too, because it shows you how, like, it's, you know, I think pacifism is one of those things that some people have a very negative view of it, because, like, oh, it's so naive, it's so, you know, that's not the way the world works. And it's like, no, it, like, in some cases it comes from experience, you know. There's a reason why Frodo doesn't want to wear a sword.
Yeah. And I like that Tolkien's always made Frodo to be the most mature of the bunch, right? And I don't feel like Tolkien is I wouldn't say in any way he's looking down on people who are willing to fight. Like, I think Merry and Pippin really get to shine in those later chapters. They're like knights of the Shire at that point, and, you know, they're revered by everybody. But really, yeah, as Frodo is, like, the most mature in his decision to, like, to be as peaceful as he can, and the way he's always cautioning, like, don't kill anyone if you don't have to. And Tolkien even says, like, when they fight the Battle of Bywater, whatever, it says Frodo's main role was to dissuade angry hobbits from killing prisoners or something. Like,
yeah.
That's all he did, and I love that. I love that he sees the value in both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and these characters have arcs that are their own, right? It's not that it's not a group of characters going through an adventure and coming out kind of all the same. They come out even more different than they went in.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because we talk a lot about hero's journey in literature. It's just kind of one of the main modes of storytelling. You know, being a teacher, all my ELA friends talk about hero's journey all the time. And it's cool with this because we get like at least four heroes' journeys, and we get to see where these different people end up when they come full circle. And as you said, like we see Frodo as being the more mature, but we also don't dismiss the more warrior types and Merry and Pippin. So it's kind of cool. You get to see these four people go on this long journey, and you get to see how they come back around full circle. And we get a glimpse of that where in this chapter when Sam is just so amazed at how Pippin and Merry have grown.
No, right.
Mr. Peregrine Took, I should say, and Mr. Merry, how they have grown.
I like when they say I almost mistook you for a dwarf, and then Gimli gets upset.
Yeah.
He's like, "You're definitely not dwarves."
Yeah. All right, what else? What else should we talk about in this chapter before we talk about cards?
I think we covered all the big stuff I had to talk about. I mean,
Yeah, I
I'm
think
with
that did
Caleb.
it for
These
me.
are really important chapters, and we could spend an entire episode on any one of them. But yeah,
Okay.
I don't have any more
Okay.
specifically about this one.
Awesome. Well, then we'll move on and talk about the cards. I think as we were describing the beginning of the chapter where the ring is destroyed and the battle ends, I couldn't help but think about the epic multiplayer in the Mountain of Firebox. And I had never done that until we were at Con of the Rings. And we even only did the Blackgate Opens part, but it was really cool to be in that big room and have some people doing, people did the Blackgate Opens and they did the Mount Doom and how those two quests interact. It was cool how they came together, just as they do in the book, where they're two separate events, but the way they overlap, I think, was portrayed really nicely in the quests. So kudos to whoever designed it. But no, that was really cool. I think even just now, as we were talking about it, it kind of crystallized for me, like, oh, that really works in terms of gameplay.
I'm really glad you enjoyed it. That was something, like I've talked before, like the sagas took so long to design and release that I've probably been talking about it for years now. And probably several years ago mentioned that there was a document that I wrote up to outline like all of the scenarios throughout all the boxes, and each one had a note in the margins about like kind of what the hook was gonna be.
So, did it take a while because of the release cycle, or just because
Played
did?
simultaneously.
Oh,
What's
sorry.
that?
I think I'm sorry. I think my connection went bad there for a second. Did they take so long to get finished because of the release cycle, or just because of the time to design and tweak them, or what was that about?
Oh yeah, just the release model. Like it
Okay.
took
Okay.
as long as we always knew it was going to take.
Okay.
But it was just like that's the only project that I've ever worked on, where I mapped something out and said, okay, over the course of 4 or 5 years, we're going to do all of this,
Yeah, that's crazy.
and making that plan like ahead of time and saying, yeah, and maybe 4 years from now I'll be designing the Blackgate Opens and Mount Doom, and the note was right, like that we should. You should be able to sit down and play them side by side, and somehow, like in real time, stuff that's happening at the Black Gate can affect what's happening at Mount Doom, and vice versa. And I remember, at the time, my manager being like, "Oh, that sounds like a really cool idea if you can pull it off." And I had no idea how we were gonna pull that off. And then we ended up, creating the epic multiplayer format for Gen Con, and I was like, "Sweet, now I know how I'm gonna do this." And
Nice.
yeah, so I just got really excited of like, well, this will make this like I wanted the end of the saga to feel like that next level epic. Like how do you top the Battle of Pelennor Fields in terms of epic scale? And I was like, I got it. You could play these, at the same time. And had so much fun with the idea of like the Black Gate is not a scenario that you can win. It's the
Yeah.
unwinnable. And we just had so much fun with that, where when we were testing it, we were just always like, how many rounds did you guys last? Like, oh,
Yeah.
we made it six. And you're like, oh man, we made it eight. What's
Yeah,
up?
that's right. We lost 2 rounds later, but we still lost. No, that is
And then
epic.
Jeremy's wearing like, he was like, can I just borrow it, take it home over the weekend? I just want to see how many turns I can survive. I'm like, sure, okay. He comes back Monday, like, so how'd it go? He's like, Oh, I quit after 99 or something. I'm like, what did you
What?
do?
He broke it.
Oh, he might have contributed to some errata and
Some
some
of the
redesigns.
changes.
I think he was using Out of
99.
the Wild to like remove the encounter deck.
Oh,
Oh,
of
there we
course.
go. That
I
is
think
in
that's
the
what led
community,
to
that
that.
is known as the C stand.
Yeah, it was pretty funny because yeah, he really liked the scenario, so he went home and broke it. Which allowed us to make it a little better. So
Sometimes
that
if you
was
love
good.
something, you just gotta break it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what they say about breaking something to understand it, right?
Gandalf had some
No,
words for
I'm
Saruman.
kidding. I'm not trying to put any knocks on Jeremy. He obviously did a good job for the community because it's nice that that quest is not breakable.
Jeremy has been playtesting with me like almost from the beginning
That's cool.
of my time on Lord of the Rings. So he has contributed a great deal at this point to the game overall. So I like to poke fun at him sometimes, but that's just kind of the friendship we have. I get mine too.
That's awesome. What cards did you want to talk about, Dano?
Captains of the West is a fun one. There's obviously a bunch of eagles that we don't need to probably dwell on.
Yeah.
Let me pull Captains of the West up because I don't even have it off the top of my furry head. Okay, quest action. Until the end of the phase, each noble hero gets +1 willpower and does not exhaust to commit to the quest. So, 3-cost leadership event from the Mountain of Firebox, even. Look at that.
Fancy.
Synergy. Yeah, just the kind of the perfect card for the epic all in on the quest round, all in on the committing to the quest round.
Yeah.
Where
Yeah, and this also
were you going to
reminds.
say, Kim?
Oh, good.
Oh, I don't know. Go ahead.
I was just going to say this is also a good. We already talked about this at the opening of the battle, but this is also cool. Moment to point towards Justice Shall Be Done. We were just talking about the unwinnable scenario, so Justice Shall Be Done came to mind. So I think if you want to get super thematic, you could throw that in next time you play this one. But
True.
what was the other one I want to talk about? Oh, I also remember this is the To the Sea chapter. So we got To the Sea, because Legolas is talking about the foam flying and whatever else. So I don't know, is this specifically the where the line comes from? Because he sings about the sea a lot. These elves are freaking obsessed. But I was trying to remember if
Yeah,
it was actually the specific
that's the
reference.
song there,
Yeah.
where he starts singing about the gulls are crying and the wind is blowing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting how Legolas's obsession with the sea like starts after the passing of the Grey Company, right? When
Yep.
they come out on the other side of the Pass of the Dead by the ocean, and after that, it's like every time we hear from Legolas after that, it's just him going, "Oh, but the ocean."
And that's why Gimli is the real hero, because he maintained his friendship even though Legolas wouldn't shut up about the sea.
Yeah, right.
It's the
It's
stubbornness
like, we get it. You
of
like the water
dwarves.
now, okay?
We get it, man.
Galadriel warned him. It turned out
That's true.
true.
Yeah, it's like the it's like Pondfar for elves. So
Dude, that was like a double nerdy
there's a
reference.
very
Well
specific
done.
reference for you
I
nerds
have
out
no
there.
idea what you're talking about,
Oh,
but I'm
Pondfar
okay
is
with
like
that.
never mind. We've already had one tangent. You can look it
That's a talk you need to have with your mom and your dad about Vulcan
When
theology.
two Vulcans love each other very much.
This is why we need the other Star Trek nerds in this.
I
I'm
know.
just like right over my head.
Yeah, I have to fill in for Ian today. Oh, and Matthew's a huge Trek
Oh
fan, right? I see him.
he's
I see
huge
his
Trekker, yeah.
Facebook updates are always like with Trek stars. That's pretty cool.
Yep. Yeah, he goes to that thing in Vegas instead of Gen Con. Well, shall we proceed to the Steward and the King?
Let's do it.
Okay. The Steward and the King is the next chapter, and Eowyn and Faramir connect in the Houses of Healing. So we jump back to them. We jump back in time a little bit. We find the pair of them in the Houses of Healing, having some Elizabethan banter. And soon Aragorn returns and is recognized by Faramir as the rightful king, and he finally enters the city as King Elessar. The companions rest and enjoy each other's company in the city after the big events of the war. Gandalf then leads Aragorn into the mountains, where he finds a very important sapling, and then in the end, some important guests arrive at Minas Tirith.
Yeah, this was another favorite chapter of mine as a young guy, a little bit of a romantic heart. I absolutely love the romance between Faramir and Eowyn. Like, Faramir's just a player. He's so smooth. I'm trying to find the little passage where, you know, they keep meeting up in the garden, and she's all sad because her brother is gone, and she's still kind of like, you know, holding a candle for Aragorn, and she's also like real fatalistic, like convinced they're all gonna die, and so like Faramir's just fallen for her, but she's not quite like reciprocating yet. So he like wins her over with this. I love like when he's saying, well, hey, as long as we're both here in the Houses of Healing, maybe we can meet up and walk at Wiles, right? And it would ease my my pain to like hang out with you sometimes. And she says, how should I ease your care? And he says, would you have my plain answer? She says, I would. He says, then Eowyn of Rohan, I say to you that you are beautiful. And this is where he gets really smooth, right? In the valleys of our hills, there are flowers fair and bright, and maidens fairer still. But neither flower nor lady have I seen now in Gondor so lovely and so sorrowful.
Dude's a player.
Like, yeah, no, I mean, like, seriously, all of a sudden he turns into a poet. He's like, yep, there's beautiful flowers, there's beautiful women, but none like you. Faramir.
Is that how you courted your wife? Bust out some Faramir?
Not quite. No, I think I took her to Old Chicago and said, you can order whatever you like.
Which in the hierarchy of romance.
Old Chicago, there are pizzas and waitresses fair.
Oh my gosh.
But not as fair as you, baby. Whatever you like.
For each according to his age, right, Caleb? I'm
That's so perfect.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Pizza's fair and bright.
That's how you know a guy really loves you, right? As we say, I like you more than pizza and beer.
Yeah. I think that's a country song.
The sweetest thing. That's great. Yeah, her transformation over this chapter is kind of awesome. There's a quote at the very beginning. Sorry to rewind time just a second, but this is I think it sets up a really good contrast in terms of what Faramir's fighting against when he's being a player, because what she says to the warden right at the very beginning of the chapter is some of my favorite Eowyn dialogue in the whole book. She's basically wants to be let out to go do real, in her mind, real things, and they're saying like, no, you still need to heal. And that's the context of this conversation. And she says, it needs but one foe to breed a war, not two, Master Warden, answered Eowyn. And those who have not swords can still die upon them. Would you have the folk of Gondor gather you herbs only when the Dark Lord gathers armies? And it is not always good to be healed in body, nor is it always evil to die in battle, even in bitter pain. So it's like super emo, you know, language there, but there's a really interesting like insight into her character there. You know, it's not always good to be healed in body. It's not always bad to die in battle. She's still like fatalistic warrior woman, wants to go out there and die with, you know, the people that she loves and, you know, show loyalty to Rohan and.
Yeah. She's almost like disappointed that she was healed.
Right.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Like you get the impression she thought it would have been better to go out fighting the Witch King. Like, what better death could you hope for?
Yep.
Which I think is, do you think, this is something that passed my mind, do you think that, obviously we're talking about a fantasy novel here, but do you think that makes her 180 less believable, where she goes from being, like, essentially suicidal, as we've said, to being like, oh, I will put the soul down, I will no longer be a shield maiden?
I it makes sense to me because she's obviously a very passionate person, and I can see that. Like, it actually makes sense to me that someone that would be all in on one thing would like finally take a step back and realize, oh wait, there are other things in life that are worth, you know, fighting for. It doesn't have to be battle.
Yeah.
Well, what I like is about this, her transformation, is I feel like She's fighting her own personal battle inside. You could say she's essentially battling with depression. So there's this grand epic battle going on between good and evil, light and dark, the West and Sauron, all of that. And it mirrors like sort of her own internal battle. Same like Frodo had his own internal struggle with the ring. Eowyn is fighting a very human battle that I think everyone can relate to. And I think maybe that's part of, again, of what I love about these books so much, is that it's not just all about the grand scale, but it's also about the people in it and how they're affected by it. And so I think she's very human. And the whole idea of like she does this dramatic 180, like that is very human.
Fair.
People do that all the time, right? Or they might over, like who knows? Maybe a week later she's kind of down in the dumps again,
That's true.
you know?
And I guess this part of the chapter is meant to span, how long is it? It's like a week or a couple weeks?
Yeah, it's over the course of a couple of days at least, because they go and meet up like each day for a while, and then heck, you can actually look in the appendix and like
Oh yeah,
gives
that's
you,
true.
that's what I love about Tolkien, right?
Day
He
by
tells you
day.
exactly what day.
Well, because the days end up mattering, because he'll have important things, course, like happen on certain important days or whatever.
It's got to line up.
Yeah, but with
It's got to
regards to her
line up.
180, that's another one of my absolute favorite lines is when she does like kind of like let go of her doom and gloom, and she looks to Faramir and says like, yes, I will love you, because I love he just like calls her out. He's like, I've got two theories about why you're still hanging out here now that you're healed. One is like basically you got nothing better to do, and the other was like you love me, and so he's like, tell me. Do you not love me? And she says like, okay, yes, I do, and I will be married to you. And then I love this though, where she looks at Faramir and says, "No longer do I desire to be a queen." Then Faramir laughed merrily. That is well, he said, "for I am not a king." Freaking love that line. He's so smooth.
That's that Numenorean blood, right? It's honey tongue.
That's
He
like,
knows how
well,
to.
my dad, my brother are dead. I better get some more people in my life. All right, so after that, the king returns, and I feel like with this particular moment, like it's very well described. Aragorn shows up, Faramir comes out. He says the last steward of Gondor begs leave to surrender his office. And I just feel like it's hard to. We talk about how emotionally invested we get with the hobbits and with the big moments in the book. I feel like I don't have a lot of emotional investment in this. Like I get that this is Aragorn's moment, but I feel like I just never had a. I've never really connected to this part because it seems like it should be a lot bigger, than the way it feels to me with the king assuming
I
his
think his
position.
moment comes with the actual crowning, right? For me, this moment's all about Faramir. Like, and it kind of makes sense because we've been following Faramir throughout the chapter to this point. And what's significant about it to me is that he's lost his brother and now his father has just died. So now he's the steward. It's like fallen to him, but he's steward for like a hot minute, and then he has to like hand over the keys to the city to Aragorn. And what I love about it though is like how he doesn't hesitate. He's like so happy. Not like I don't think he's in a hurry to give up the responsibility. Like he's like, oh geez, I didn't know how to run the city anyway. It's more like this is what a steward does, right? When the king returns, you give it back. And I love Aragorn's response then is the way of saying, okay, yeah, I'm gonna move in the city, but I'm not releasing you from your office. It's going to be yours and your heirs for as long as my line reigns as kings, and I love that.
I think it goes back to what I was saying about archetypal good. Aragorn is the ideal king who's humble enough to give honor where honor is due, and Faramir is the ideal steward who's willing to lay it down. We obviously get a very bad example of a steward in Denethor, but he very willingly lays down his position in a proper way. So I can see that.
I love the comic relief with Iorath, being
Oh
shushed again,
yes.
Hilarious.
Dude.
Yeah.
Faramir is like introducing Aragorn, and he's the son of Arathorn, chieftain of the Dunedain, and captain of the host of the West, and on, right? And he says, "Will you have him be king and enter the city and dwell here, and everyone cries out, yay. And then Ioris says to her kinswoman, this is just a ceremony such as we have in the city, cousin, for he has already entered, and I was telling you, and he said to me, and it just gets
yeah.
cut off.
But Ioris was not permitted to continue.
My note for that entire paragraph is just lol.
Lol. I can't ever, I can't not hear,
hilarious.
And I can't not hear her in the voice of Terry Jones from Monty Python, like doing a woman, like the whole, like,
oh,
like
yes.
the whole, mud scene at the beginning of, the Holy Grail. I was like, I thought we were an autonomous collective, like that whole bit, like that voice. That's how Ira sounds to me for perpetuity.
Some watery tot hurls a scimitar and suddenly you've got divine right.
That's amazing.
But we'll come back to her.
Yeah, no, that's the perfect voice for Ereth.
Didn't know we had a king. I
always
kind of
heard her like the actress from the Pride and Prejudice miniseries. You know, like, oh, Mr. Darcy.
Oh yes, the mom. Yeah,
just said that over the top. It's just really dramatic and self-important.
Yeah. I would like to talk about the part where Gandalf takes Aragorn up into the mountains, and they find the sapling of Nimloth. Because I feel like there's a lot here to unpack, and I'd like to hear what you think, Caleb. So I was thinking. So first of all, there's the internal genealogy of the tree, where Gandalf says it's a sapling of Nimloth, and that was the seedling of Galathelion, and that was a fruit of Telperion, the eldest of trees. So that goes all the way back to even before the sun came up. All the way back to the ages of stars.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, but then I started thinking about the symbolism behind the tree, and you know, I didn't do a deep dive or anything, but even the little bit that I looked into, trees are symbols of order. Trees are symbols of connecting, in especially in the ancient world, connecting heaven and earth. Trees are symbols of hierarchy in a sense. So I just feel so And plus,
and
we see
the symbol of the House of Elendil.
Exactly. I was going to say, we see the tree everywhere because of that. But like underneath that, there's a lot of interesting stuff we can unpack. It's not just for T-shirts or for podcast logos.
Yeah, it was. I remember reading this as a kid, and the tree was totally lost on me.
Yeah.
This was like. You get the coronation, and I love like how Aragorn's like, you know, let Gandalf or it's like let Frodo carry it to me, let Gandalf put it on my head, you know, he's crowned king and it's an epic moment, and you kind of expect the chapter to end there.
Yeah.
Right? You're like, what more is there to do in this chapter? And then it's like they're kind of like waiting around, and he seems a little restless, and you're like, what's going on? He's king. Sauron's dead. Aragorn's king. And there's like, he goes up in the mountain with Gandalf, and he finds a sapling, and he's like, okay, now everything's good. And it was so lost on me as a kid. I was like, what just happened? And it had nothing to do with my age. It's because I hadn't read the Silmarillion yet.
Right.
And that's one thing that I love about Tolkien, is kind of indulging himself, like, he doesn't care if you get this reference or not. Like,
exactly.
It means a lot to him. And when you read the Silmarillion, you're like, oh, that's amazing. You know. But if this is your first time reading this book, you're like, okay, whatever.
Yeah, whatever you say, man.
Like, I'm glad you found your tree, bro.
Yeah. And it's kind of cool, too. He's like, he'll do his own thing. Because people say that about Tom Bombadil. Like, for the most part, it's just kind of this thing he wanted to throw in there. But obviously the tree is a little bit more meaningful. But yeah, I'm down with the tree. And even the imagery of transition, where the old one is dying, the new one can now be planted.
And they don't even burn it, right? They like practically give it a burial ceremony. The old dead tree.
Yeah, the tree that was in the garden there, outside of the tower of Ecthelion, and I love that too. Like, the tree is definitely like a symbol for like Denethor, you know. Like, it's just. He's just like, he's just not fit for the times. He doesn't, you know, it's the downfall of Minas Tirith. It's the downfall of the blood of Numenor. Yeah. And so the symbolism.
It's the third age,
like,
even too, though. Yeah. Right? Like, it's the tree represents that. Like, it had to die because that was the ring. Right. The death of the ring is the death of the third age.
Mm-hmm. So then they get rid of the, you're right, very, very reverently, very respectfully get rid of the dead tree and then replace it now with the fresh young sapling of this like really amazing lineage, right?
Right. Perticure.
I mean, it's a pretty transparent, metaphor for Aragorn and his line,
Right.
right?
Yep.
Yep.
The House of Strider.
Yeah.
Right. Let's see. Well, then, of course, at the very end, we have, you mentioned how Aragorn was kind of restless, and then he says, "The sign has been given. The day is not far off." And then all of a sudden, a fair company shows up. We get Eladan and Elrahir and Glorfindel and Aristor and Galadriel and basically a Noldor deck just gets plopped
Yeah,
all
it's
over
like
the
the
chair.
who's who of the Noldor.
Yeah.
It's everybody.
And then
The
his
Lords of the Eldar.
and then his then his wedding gets one sentence.
Yeah, right? Isn't that interesting? It's like, and then they were married on Midsummer, and the tale of their long-waiting labors was come to fulfillment. I love that you're like, what tale of waiting and labor? It's like, read the appendix. Oh, that's great. It's another amazing story that he's just kind of indulged for himself. I love that part of the appendix, though.
Oh yeah, it's a great story, and that's cool. We talked about the trees, and even the way that connects with Beren and Lúthien and stuff. It's like he spent his whole life writing this
Echoes.
stuff. Yeah,
He loves putting echoes in his work, though.
I'm down with
Yeah,
that. Arwen and
I
Aragorn
personally
is
enjoy
an
that.
echo.
I like that symmetry or cyclical kind of storytelling. I really like that.
Very old school.
It's very traditional. Exactly. Like you look at the old myths and they'll tell they'll tell the same story a million times and people say, okay, we want a new story. So they'll take the same story and change the name of the characters and then tweak the plot. And they're really telling you the same story, but they're telling it to you just differently enough that you don't know how it's going to end,
Yeah, for sure.
which is kind of cool.
All right, anything else in this chapter before we talk about some cards?
Are there cards per se? I
Well, I
guess.
put
Oh,
so I
Houses of Healing and
yeah,
Eorath,
I
yeah.
included Houses of Healing and the Eorath. I wasn't sure if we actually talked about them during the Houses of Healing chapter, but they're at least worth highlighting.
I mean, Eorath is comedy gold in this chapter,
Yeah,
so.
so even if we already talked about her, we got to talk about her again. Yeah, so these are pretty straightforward cards. Hounds of Healing is the big health bomb. You exhaust your healers to reduce the cost, and then put the hero back into play with one damage token on it. Which there aren't a lot of ways to bring heroes back, so this is cool. Cool, and I don't know, very thematic. And I don't know. You got any design notes for us on this one?
That was a Matt Newman
Oh, it
card.
was Newman. Okay, cool.
I really like that one where he was just like, "Hey, look, we got enough people with the healer trait now. Let's do something with it."
Yeah.
And he's like, "Wouldn't it be cool if like lore had a way to bring someone back and not just spirit?" And I was like, "Heck yeah, that looks cool."
Heck yeah, meeting over. Let's get some lunch.
Yeah, I feel like my heck yeah means I really deserve credit for it. No, I'm kidding.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's fun to see the trait synergy stuff kind of come into it, like non-racial traits, right? The what do you call those?
Yeah, kind of like classes.
Yeah, a
Yeah,
class trait.
like
There
the
you go.
warrior
Class
class,
traits come
ranger
into it.
class. Yeah, it's funny too because we definitely talk about them that way in the office, but of course, there's nothing in the rules that actually says there are different types of traits. They're all just traits, but
Yeah.
people just kind of recognize like, oh, this is the race, and this is what they do,
Yeah.
you know.
The class, I like that. Especially with
Yeah.
the campaign mode where you can kind of add those classes, and that's cool.
I would have loved to do a card for the sapling of the white tree, but it would have been so anachronistic to the entire game, including the saga expansions. Like there just wasn't a time that it would fit to play it. But I
What would be a
remember,
weird, be a
what
weird
would it
boon.
do even? Yeah.
Well, I remember it from
It's a weapon attachment.
the middle. Yeah, right. Yeah, you can beat people with it. I remember it from the Middle Earth CCG. That was like one of the decks I like to play. It was like Aragorn had all the best toys, and so
As he should.
he could go get the sapling and then like bring it to Minas Tirith and plant it, and then you could replace it with the white tree and score a bunch of points. And it was a very fun thematic moment, but it got a little repetitive because it's like that's what you would do. Like I'll go get it, I'll plant it, I'll score some points.
Yeah.
Well, that was fun.
The epicness starts to wear off a little bit.
Yeah. And plus, it was kind of a cheat. Like, everybody else who had like a cool epic thing, they had to like travel to Mount Doom or
So
Erebor, visit
dangerous.
Smaug. Yeah, they had to like go travel through some really
You're hanging
dangerous
out at Minas
plants.
Tirith,
Yeah, and
but it's all
Erebor was like,
safe.
I'll just go to Minas Tirith, I'll be fine.
Just go to my backyard.
It's Judge.
Yeah, so are we doing many partings?
Let's do
Let's do
this.
it.
Chapter 6 is Many Partings, and after Aragorn and Arwen's marriage, the company sets out. They go to Rohan, then they go to Isengard to visit Treebeard, where they learn of Saruman's escape. They pass Saruman and Wormtongue on the road, and after that, they return to Rivendell and see Bilbo once again. So we're back on the road with this chapter.
The road again.
So that's what Gandalf was singing, the Willie Nelson hair. But you know, you talked about Caleb earlier that some people complain that it should just end when the ring is gone. But we've got a lot of loose ends to wrap up, and I feel like this is the chapter where the most loose ends get wrapped up because we bump into just about everybody that we've seen. From where the company of the ring sets out, we even get the little, drum beat from Gone Burry Gone as they pass through the woods there. So I
Yeah, because
don't.
he stops there, right, to pronounce as king that like no one will be allowed to enter those woods. I thought that was cool. That's actually one of my favorite things too. Like Dan was talking about what a great example Aragorn is, that you see like as soon as he's king, like everything he does is to give recognition to everyone who helped him to get there. And what's interesting about the woes is, and the way he gives them recognition is, they didn't impact him directly, right? He learned from Éomer that the Rohirrim were able to pass through the woods undetected. And so he's even given sort of like secondhand recognition, right?
Yeah, I just finished reading a book about the Byzantine Empire, and even like the good emperors would take what they could out of the sense of self-defense and extending their realm and things like that. So in that sense, he should have just swept in and taken the woods, even though they were helpful, but he doesn't. He, as you said, he recognizes their contribution and he just lets them go back to hunting and
Well, he does the same
stealing your
thing with the
resources.
Shire, right? Later on with the Shire, he pronounces that no one in his realm will enter the Shire without, like basically an invitation from the hobbits. Like even though the Shire falls squarely within the northern part of his realm, he's like, the hobbits can be self-governed, and he basically offers them protection, but doesn't like ask anything in return.
Yeah, kind of. I don't know. I always get the sense of like he's comfortable with his position and with himself as king. So when you have that kind of security, you're not worried about taking everything you can. Let's see.
Truth.
Truth. We get an emotional farewell from Merry to Théoden because they finally. I think this is what I think about when I hear about think about Théoden sitting in the throne room of Minas Tirith for like weeks. And then finally getting buried, I'm thinking, man, how stinky is that corpse by now?
Ripe.
But I guess,
I'm sure they had, didn't they? They had like ways of treating them, right? Like
yeah. Actually, I think didn't they mention embalm?
the
Didn't
elves
Denethor
the
mention
elves use
embalmment?
Fabulosa. It's one of the things
Fabulosa.
that Tolkien doesn't specifically mention. It's in one of the appendices that the elves actually have Fabulosa, and that's why you don't smell the ripe body.
It's one of those things, kind of like you never read about Sam and Frodo taking a dump in the woods. It's kind of like that. It's like we don't need to include all the details. It's fine.
As opposed to Martin, who would give us like the
Right.
shape of the smell and like how long it took, what he was thinking about while he went.
The woman he was going to get with afterwards.
Jeez.
Wow.
So
Way to
trying to rein it back in here. What am I
encapsulate George
absolutely?
R. R. Martin. Sorry.
That's okay. But yeah, one of my all-time like favorite moments from the books too is in this chapter where it's another really funny moment where earlier when Éomer met Gimli for the first time, you remember, was like on the plains of Rohan and they were chasing the Uruk-hai, and they explained that they had just come out of Lorien, and Éomer's like, oh, we heard that like the Lady of the Wood is like a sorceress and she's dangerous and stuff, and like Gimli's like ready to kill him,
Yeah.
like Like, he's like, the only excuse you have is that you speak out of folly or something like
Yep. I
that,
don't know what you're talking
you
about.
know? And so he's telling him, like, if you ever meet the Lady of Lorien, you will tell me that she's the fairest in the world, or I will kill you, right? And so they have this moment. I love it, where it's like, where is
Éomer,
here?
soon,
Right, where they meet after Aragorn and Arwen are married, and Éomer, he sends for Gimli the dwarf, and he says to him, "Gimli, Glóin's son, have you your axe ready?" "Nay, lord," said Gimli, "but I can fetch for it speedily if there be need." Éomer says, "You shall judge, for there are certain rash words concerning the Lady of the Golden Wood that lie still between us, and now I have seen her with my eyes." "Well, lord," said Gimli, "what say you now?" "Alas," said Éomer, "I will not say that she is the fairest lady that lives." "Then I must go for my axe," said Gimli. "But first, I will plead this excuse," said Éomer. "Had I seen her in other company, I could have said all that you wish. But now I will put Queen Arwen Evanstar first, and I am ready to do battle on my part with any who deny me. Shall I call for my sword?"
Funny.
Then Gimli bowed low. "Nay, you are excused for my part, lord," he said, "for you have chosen the evening, but my love is given to the morning." I love that. That's like, it's like this just really funny, macho, kind of comical moment where it seems like they might actually fight over this, and instead it ends on this almost like poetry of, "I get it. You've chosen the evening. I love the morning. We're just, to each their own."
Respect.
That's the Tolkien equivalent of a fist bump right there, by the way.
Right? Yeah, I just love that. Like, then I must call for my axe.
Yep, well, I'm gonna go get my axe now.
There's a just a lot of little lines in this chapter that are very insightful to different characters, and I don't know why, but I really love when Treebeard is describing Saruman, and he just says he always was hasty. And you realize, like, how, as old as Treebeard is and as much of a perspective he has on things, for him to say that about Saruman is incredibly insightful.
Yeah, that's I like there's too, like, we get a hint of how it was that Saruman was able to escape when Treebeard's explaining, "You know how I hate to imprison things. Like, I don't like to keep things in cages." And you know that Saruman was just working them, just day after day. Like, "I can't believe you keep me locked up in here." Goes against everything you claim to believe in, that kind of. And Gandalf just like, he's like, I should have known.
Just
What
big
can
old
you
softy. And it's a good bit of foreshadowing too, because Gandalf has the line, "This snake had still one tooth left," and that's where he talks about, how he persuaded Treebeard. But we get a bit of foreshadowing there, and then again when we pass Sauron and Wormtongue on the road, that trouble is afoot.
Yeah, speaking of foreshadowing, Merry gets his horn from
Oh
Éowyn.
yeah,
And I love
yeah.
that when she says, like, "He that blows it at need shall set fear in the hearts of his enemies and joy in the hearts of his friends." And it seems like kind of a strange thing for her to be talking about, like, when the war is over, but I love how, like, it's only like a chapter or two later when he does blow the horn, and it
Yeah.
does make the ruffians flee, and it does, rouse the Shire. It's such a cool thing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I have
Gimli
a
and
qu
Legolas visit the glittering caves and Fangorn. I love that too. Like, he's tying up every loose end
Yeah.
in this chapter. It's
Everything.
amazing.
Everything gets tied up. I have one question for you guys, though. There was one line of dialogue that, as I went through, I noted it, and I don't quite understand. It's probably like a Second Age reference or something. But when they're saying their goodbyes, and Galadriel says to him, "Elfstone, through darkness, you have come to your hope, and you have now all you desire. Use well the days." That makes total sense. But then Celeborn says, "Kinsman, farewell. May your doom be other than mine." What is he saying right there?
Well, because Galadriel leaves him to go back to Valinor.
Oh,
And so
gotcha.
he's separated from her. And that
Gotcha.
always kind of puzzled me too, because I'm like, why can't Celeborn go? Like, is it just his choice that he loves Middle-earth and doesn't want to leave? I always thought that was interesting.
Celeborn is Sindar, is he not?
Right, but I mean, at one point, all the elves were invited, to Valinor. And clearly they make exceptions for Gimli, Bilbo, Frodo. Like, I don't believe that Manwë's going, sure, Galadriel, you can come, but that Celeborn character's got to stay. So for me, I've
I
always
mean,
read
he's a
it as like
trophy husband.
Celeborn.
Maybe that's why they wouldn't let him in.
What's that?
He's Celeborn's just a trophy husband. That's why they wouldn't let him in.
Celeborn's an interesting character in the books because Galadriel actually refers to him at one point as being the wisest person in Middle-earth, and and a gift giver beyond the ability of kings or whatever. So he's clearly very important, but that's all we really know. We know he's important. We don't really know why beyond that he leads the Galadrim.
I find the superlatives always very interesting. We talked about that a little bit in our discussion about who's older, the oldest thing.
Oh, right.
Treebeard, Gandalf calls Treebeard eldest, but then talks about how Tom was the first thing. And there's a lot there to unpack just about we mentioned myths and things like that. But yeah, I always find that kind of talk very interesting.
Yeah, but my interpretation was always just that Celeborn did not want to leave Middle-earth. There's so much in Tolkien's portrayal of elves, of how much they love the land and they love the world, and that they're more closely bound to it than humans, right?
Yeah, it's one of the things that I love about the story of the Lord of the Rings is that it manages to have a happy ending that is not that is complex, because it really is, when if you look at it from the elves' perspective, it's a sad ending. Like it's the best possible ending, but it's still sad, which
Yeah,
is
I like
interesting.
that Galadriel foreshadows that, like in the Mirror of Galadriel chapter, where she explains like some think that if Sauron's destroyed, then the three will be free to restore everything as it once was, and others think that if the one is destroyed, then the three shall also fade, and we will pass. And she's like, either way, you're coming as the footsteps of doom. You know, it's just like there's a little more of that fatalism.
It really makes for a dramatic transition, right? When they it's not just talk when they're saying now, the fourth age is the age of men. It really is, because you have hobbits getting kind of isolated off, and the dwarves are going to stay underground, and the elves are going to all go over the ocean, and it really men are going to take over everything.
We get a bit of that with this is was something I want to talk about with you guys. I don't know how much there is to unpack, but we get the scene after they get away from Saruman, who's just nasty, where the three, Elrond, Galadriel, and Gandalf, are sitting there, and little would someone have seen or heard, and it would seem to him only that they saw gray figures. They did not move or speak with their mouths, looking from mind to mind. And I can't remember where I read this, because I've read so much Tolkien stuff over the years, but in the movies, there's some hint that elves are just telepathic. And I remember in one of the behind the scenes bit, Peter Jackson actually just says, "Oh yeah, elves are telepathic." But I think that was just a misunderstanding on the part of him and his writing team, because the only reason these three can communicate that way is because of their rings, right?
That'd be my guess. I never saw anything anywhere else aside from that passage there that would suggest that elves have telepathic powers.
Yeah, and then the next line is, they parted again for a while until it was time for the three rings to pass away. So it's like it's got to be that. But that, goes back to what you were saying, Dan, about how the rings are also leaving. We're coming into a very boring, disenchanted time in Middle Earth.
I mean, the next step after the rings leaving is fidget spinners, and what's good about that?
It's real Dale make. It's the hottest thing in the Dale toy market.
Nice. Nice. Way to tie it back in.
That's what I'm here for.
What would we do without you, Derek?
We would have very few tying things back in. And then we finally get back to Mr. Bilbo.
Bilbo Baggins.
And I love just how he's just an old hobbit now. Just hanging, he's just sleeping a lot. He's talking about all the stuff he's going to do, but he's never actually going to do because he's too old.
Get
And
off the lawn.
exactly.
Oh my gosh, he's got one of the saddest lines though,
Which one?
right? When he's like, "Hey, how about that ring of mine? Have you got it with you?"
Oh, is that
And he's
here?
just like, "Oh,
I
it's
would
just so
love to see it
heartbreaking,
one
isn't it?
more
Isn't it
time.
in this chapter?"
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's right near the end, which reminds me, what's become of my ring, Frodo, that you took away? I've lost it, oh dear, said Frodo. I got rid of it, you know. What a pity, said Bilbo. I should have liked to see it again. But no, how silly of me. Like, it's just sad.
Very, very bittersweet.
But yeah, it all kind of comes back around, as we've been saying. It all started with Bilbo, and then, of course, we're gonna, spoiler alert, we're gonna see Bilbo one more time again at the Grey Havens, so
Spoiler.
it's all getting looped together.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. This is the one time people go to Rivendell and they don't make a big deal about it.
Yeah. They just
Like,
show up. It's like, all right, can we go
it's
now?
like, oh, and they got to Rivendell, and for me, there's something real subtle in that too, that like maybe Rivendell's even a quieter place now. Like maybe they've already started to feel the effects,
Yeah,
of
because
the
no,
fading.
I think you're definitely onto something there. Because I think there's a point at which they talk about how the valley is basically maintained by Elrond's magic, and this magic comes from the rings. So if the rings are starting to lose their power, then yeah, that's a good observation.
It just
Not
struck me right
quite.
now that like every other time people go to Rivendell, it's like the in The Hobbit, the elves are singing and making fun of the dwarves, and it's a big deal. And then of course in the Fellowship, it's like they're escaping from the Nazgul, and every yeah, all the time. So you can tell that Elrond just loves Rivendell, and he makes it out to be like the perfect place
Yeah.
to just hang out. And then yeah, it's almost like oh, that's right, they're in Rivendell now, aren't they? In this chapter.
Yeah, the rings leaving is not one discrete moment. It's like a process, right? They've already kind of been like they call it like diminishing or whatever, where the elves' influence over Middle Earth has been eroding over time.
Well, anything else before we put a bow on this one?
Nothing from me. It's
Not
really a
good.
lot of fun talking book club with the designer of our favorite game, so.
For sure.
Well, likewise, I've been listening to you guys' book club series since the beginning, and I've enjoyed hearing you unpack, each chapter and talk about things that stood out to you. And on more than one occasion, you've talked about something that I was like, huh, I did not think about it that way,
All
and
right.
so it's fun to be it's fun to be a part of that after listening to it for so long. So thanks for having
Yeah, dude, thanks
me.
again for
Thanks.
being our guest today. And you're not involved with that Journeys in Middle-earth game, are you?
I am not.
Okay, I
I
was gonna
had the
check.
opportunity to play test it a couple of times, long enough ago that I don't remember very well, like if it's changed much since then.
Okay.
My kind of like takeaway was that it's kind of like Imperial Assault for Lord of the Rings,
Okay, cool.
and that's a good thing.
Well, I was gonna,
Yeah.
if you had worked on it, I was gonna pump you for questions, but
Oh,
I'm not gonna
No,
do
I don't have time to work on every Lord of the Rings related
that.
project.
Well, just with, I know, you were heavily involved with the digital game, so I figure like you're the resident wizard there, and whenever there's a Lord of the Rings question, I imagine them just, you're probably sitting there smoking your pipe and they come and bother you about something.
They do from time to time ask like a lore related question, but I'm not the only big fan of Lord of the Rings at
Cool.
FFG. The people working on that game have a pretty solid foundational understanding of the lore.
Cool.
Well, I will say the fact that there is a book that got passed to you when you took over the reins of designing the game is a really good sign. I know that sounds silly to say, but I think one of the reasons why I really am skeptical of licensed games is that a lot of them, you get the sense that somebody was like, oh, I'm designing this licensed game. I've seen the movies. Cool, let's go make a game.
Gosh, sometimes the movies are directed by people who don't even care about the property.
Right, that's
Yeah.
true. That's
Yeah,
funny.
absolutely.
Yeah, no, I've played some of those games too, where you get really excited for whatever your favorite thing is that you're into, and you learn that there's going to be a game, and you get all excited, and then you play it, and you're like, this doesn't feel anything like this
Yeah.
world that's really precious to me. And so that's always been like, that was my personal gaming experience before coming to FFG. And so that's always been on my mind when I'm designing, is that like playing Lord of the Rings should make you feel like
Right.
you're in Middle Earth, and the characters should feel like those characters. And of course, everyone's got their own take on what Middle Earth feels like and what the characters are like. So I'm not gonna hit it every mark for every person, but it's been satisfying through the years to see that by and large, people resonate with the card designs.
Definitely. Yeah, and I think that's part of the reason why we had to make sure we got you on the book club before we wrapped it up, because you have put a lot into the game because you care so much about the book. So I'm very glad to finally have you on for this one. So thanks
Oh,
again for
thank
coming
you.
on. I'm glad the stars aligned and we were able to make this happen.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, this has been episode 67 of the Gray Company podcast, brought to you by our patrons. If you'd like to help us with hosting fees and so forth, please get to patreon.com/grayco to sign up. As always, you can get in touch with us through our website, graycompanypodcast.com. From there, you can connect with us on the various social media outlets, and you can always email us at thegraycompanypodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again to our guest, and thanks so much to you for listening, and until next time, farewell.
All right, everybody.
Awesome. Perfect. So we'll cut the
Well,
song in there.
King half passed through. That's hard to say.
King hath passed truth.
Right? So the king hath passed through.
Your these and thines.
Yeah.
What the king's English, man. All right, here we go.